on radio, streaming live on investtalk.com, and for our podcast subscribers. This is InvestTalk, above average investing for the average investor. InvestTalk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. And now, KPP Financial Executive Vice President, Financial Advisor, Justin Klein.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to InvestTalk. This is our Monday, August 3rd edition of InvestTalk, and I'm glad you can join us. I hope everyone had a great weekend and ready to tackle these very interesting markets that we have for us this summer. You know, the month of August tends to be a pretty volatile month, and today didn't really change that sentiment. Not a big mover, but certainly was a lot of volatility. So we'll talk about that and more coming up on InvestTalk, and we try to answer your money questions live here on the radio between 4 and 5 Pacific time or after hours as well. You can always call our 24-hour listener line. We'll try to answer that question on the next InvestTalk. Now, we get a lot of questions about the criteria for a good stock purchase, and there are really two important issues to consider. First, one is the quality of the stock itself. Then there's the question of how it fits in your portfolio. Right? There's two sides. Is this a good stock, or is this a good company? Is it a good investment generally? And then does it fit in your portfolio based on your own risk tolerance? Can you handle that type of investment? So let's focus on the stock itself. Now, when buying the stock of a company, investors should primarily focus on the fundamentals of that particular company, which is always the most important aspect of investing. But during times of uncertainty, it can be technical analysis that will help you protect your assets, and every investor must have basic knowledge of chart reading in order to really fully understand when to enter exit stock. Now, it can be hard to manage risk and control your emotions no matter what, but technical analysis can help you with that. And the most basic chart pattern is support and resistance levels. Those are the basics of reading charts. These patterns help determine when to get in and out, entry and exit points for these stocks. Moving averages are usually very helpful as well, and they can be support and resistance levels to look at. So understanding the general direction of stock is important. Understanding the support and resistance is important, and understanding valuation is also important as well. And in the end, technical analysis is really all about discipline and recognition, right? So it's understanding how to recognize a bullish from a bearish phase, trend line support, moving average support, certain other indicators that are available. You can get really bogged down with technical analysis, but if you understand the basics and you keep it simple, it can be a very, very powerful tool. So make sure everybody out there, beginner, experienced, have at least basic knowledge about technical analysis. It's extremely important. Now, do you have a question for me about technical analysis, about fundamental analysis? How do you know whether a company is profitable or not? How do you know if those profits are healthy? How do you know if a company is financially sound, right? How is their balance sheet safe? These are questions you need to ask yourself when you're investing in a company. So if you have any questions on how to maybe answer those questions about individual companies, give me a call. Now, how many stocks should you have in your portfolio? How many sectors? What sectors are good? Let's talk about it. Our number is 888-99-CHART. And let's take this question now from our 24-hour listener line.
Hello, this is Steve calling from Bend, Oregon. I appreciate your show and listen to you on podcast. I have a question regarding mutual funds, and I noticed that there is a difference in just standard mutual funds and similar mutual funds that are for annuities. For example, with Fidelity, their biggest stock mutual fund is the Contra Fund, which is FCNTX. And then there's another mutual fund that's called the Contra Fund that's called the VIP Fund, which is for annuities, FPDFC. I guess my main question is, why is there a difference between the two? I noticed that the holdings within the two are different. Why do they need a different mutual fund for annuities than they do for non-annuities? Why can't the annuity just use the regular mutual fund for its, I assume it's for deferred annuity. So I'm just kind of confused about the difference and appreciate your comment about that. Thank you.
All right. That's a great question because it's true. If you have a variable annuity, a lot of times, universal life, a lot of times, where you're invested in particular mutual funds. That's how you get exposure to the market, and there's certain parameters around what your returns will be and what you get locked in at, and you know they can be very complex. And a lot of times, your investment options are mutual funds, and mutual funds that you can typically buy in a normal brokerage account, but are specifically for annuities or annuity contracts. And the main reason usually is fees and structure and where they're held and liquidity, etc. So, and a lot of times the funds within the annuities have higher fees. And that's typical on a traditional mutual fund side as well. There's different share classes between each particular mutual fund. Now, some mutual funds only have one share class. That's kind of the rarity. But most of them have multiple share classes. So just think of the annuity version of that fund as a different share class, and each share class has different fee structures. So there really isn't a lot of difference when it comes to the underlying exposure to the assets in that mutual fund, whether it's stocks or bonds or whatever. But it's really all about the fees that are being charged. And typically, the fees inside those annuity mutual funds are higher than what you get inside of a traditional brokerage account with that same mutual fund. Like he's saying, Fidelity Contra Fund. That's what he was talking about. So that's why I always say it's better to get a fixed annuity or a term life policy, not a universal life, not a variable annuity. You want to get very simple insurance products. Don't get complex insurance products. You're going to pay a lot less for the simple products. They're going to convince you to go with the more complex products because they're quote-unquote investments. Well, guess what? You'd be better off saving that money, putting it into an IRA, putting it into a brokerage account, and investing in the lower cost funds, mutual funds, and you'll do much better off over the long term. Now, are you expecting too much from your stocks? It's our main talking point today that I want to get to and figure out, is the recent performance of the market, is that typical? Is that what you should be expecting going forward? What do the valuations say? And what are the various opinions? There are many opinions on this. And I'm going to get to many of them, and we'll discuss those on today's show. But also, I want to discuss the dollar strength. What's it doing to sales of multinational companies, earnings? Is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? We're going to touch on that. And I also want to talk about Puerto Rico. Let's get a little perspective. They just announced this morning they're defaulting on their debt. And we had a client that actually took some money, not at our behest at all, took some money out of our management and put it into Puerto Rican bonds because they were chasing that yield. Puerto Rican bonds were getting big yield, big dividends. And they thought that was a great place to be. And we try to warn them that's a lot of risk and you could be fine, but odds are you'll run into a speed bump at some point. And now we see that speed bump. And is it going to turn into just a small speed bump, or is it going to turn into something like a giant pothole that's going to derail the portfolios of the people that hold these bonds? So I want to talk about Puerto Rico and put that into a little more perspective. Now, a reminder about Steve's monthly retirement checkup schedule. He is going to be in San Jose mañana, tomorrow, for these individual meetings with our listeners, with our current clients. If you want to take advantage of this free service, you can call our 24-hour listener line, 888-99-CHART, and follow the prompts. He does have one spot left open for tomorrow, so if you want to get in and meet with him in San Jose, give that number a call and just follow the prompts and we'll get a meeting set up. Or you can also go to investtalk.com and click on the schedule meeting button. Let's go to Joe in Modesto. How you doing, Joe?
I'm doing great, Justin. Thanks for taking my call. Appreciate it. I
Thanks for
listen to you
making
guys every day. It's been my New Year's resolution to get my financial house in order, and you're on one of my favorite subjects today, and that's fundamental analysis.
Okay.
I'm working on my investment plan, in particular exit and entry strategies.
Okay.
And 6 months ago, I knew nothing about this. But as long as you're on this subject, I'm having a hard time understanding PEG and price sales.
Okay. What don't you, well, price sales is pretty simple. That's just the total market cap of the company, right, which is the number of shares outstanding times the current price, and that's what you get the market cap. And then you divide that by sales for a full fiscal year. Okay? So, and
And
that,
what numbers are good? What are we looking for there?
well, the lower the better, but every industry is different. High margin industries like software, for example, which tend to have high margins. Microsoft, for example, has margins in excess of, I believe, 70% or so. They usually have higher price sales ratios because their profitability levels are higher, which those sales translate into more earnings. So the high margin industries tend to have higher price sales ratios. So what you have to do is compare them from their competitors. What is this company's price sales versus their competitors in their industry that have very similar businesses? That's how you compare it. And so software companies will have much higher price sales ratios than, for example, commodity companies, which tend to have lower profitability percentages, and which so that means that those sales translate into less earnings. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. No, explain that.
And then you asked about the PEG, which is the PEG ratio, the PE divided by the growth. So the PE is pretty simple, right? Price divided by the earnings per share. And then the growth rate, right? And over you divide that number by the growth rate. And obviously you want a higher growth rate, low PE, high growth rate. So you want something, a GP that's very low. Under one is usually better, meaning that the PE is lower than the actual growth rate. Right?
Okay.
And that's
So
what you're
under
really
one is
looking for.
right. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Justin.
Thanks for calling, Joe. Glad I could answer your questions on today's Invest Talk, and we hope to make the best of our hour together coming up, and hopefully you are a part of the mix. The lines are open for your questions. I'd like to hear about your retirement portfolio, its contents, its mix. Why are you invested that way? What companies are you looking at? What companies are you holding? Check in now at 888-99-CHART.
Thanks again for subscribing to our podcast, Reasons to Add REITs to Your Portfolio. That's our talking point for Tuesday's podcast. Bring your questions and join us then.
Let's go to Art in Menlo Park. How you doing, Art?
Good. How are you, Justin?
Doing good.
Great. I just had a question. If we go into a deflationary cycle, what sectors would do well in that type of an environment?
Oh, wow. A deflationary corporate or high-grade corporate bonds, high-grade government bonds, those probably would do fairly well.
Okay.
Safe assets, let's say that.
Okay, how about like dividend type paying stocks? Would those do well, like in the oil sector or something?
They
like
would. You know, deflation means falling prices, right? So you have to ask yourself, what sectors would do well with falling prices? Well, companies that have good pricing power, meaning if prices fall, they don't really need to lower their prices too much because they still have strong, steady demand. So big blue chip companies that have, you know, economic moats, I think the companies like Apple's of the world, companies that Procter and Gamble's of the world, I think they would do well. You know, the big blue chip names, dividends, yeah, I could see those doing fairly well. I'm not saying that they would go up. I think they actually still go down in a strongly deflationary environment. They would just probably do better than the overall market or the average stock.
Oh, okay.
All right,
Justin, thanks a lot.
Thanks for calling. Great question about deflation because, you know, you're seeing a lot of issues right now. I'm seeing a lot of debt problems with a lot of coal companies are going under. We're seeing the problems in Puerto Rico. That's an issue. Obviously, Greece is an issue that is still ongoing, even though they think it's solved, but it's still somewhat ongoing. So there are a lot of deflationary factors, and that's really the strong dollar. The strong dollar is driving a deflationary environment, and that's why I think it's going to be difficult for the Fed to really raise rates by any significant amount without causing even worse deflation than we're already dealing with. So let's take a quick look at the markets today. The S&P was down 6, the NASDAQ down 13, the Dow was down 92 points. You had commodities were down slightly. You had bonds were up, you had interest rates fall. And you had the Russell 2000 was down about 0.5%. So that was really the market today. It was weak. It rallied late in the day a little bit. But overall, the market continued to be weak. And it has been weak for the past 2 months or so. And you see a lot of stocks that are in over 20% of the S&P 500 is in bear market territory, meaning they're down over 20%. So this is a very narrow market right now that's keeping the averages roughly near their all-time highs. So just understand we are in a precarious situation. It's not dire by any means. Lower oil prices are positive. You still have the housing market that is doing okay, even though it weakened a little bit last month. You have unemployment doing fairly well. But the big question is that going to continue with the stronger dollar, with more defaults, layoffs, higher minimum wage? There's a lot of things that the market is starting to try to adjust to, and higher rates is one of them, and it'll be interesting to see if it can handle that. So that was really the market today, and to transition nicely into today's talking point, I want to discuss what you should be expecting from the markets going forward. Should you be expecting big gains? Now, historically, the markets returned about 10% per year. Historically, on average. Now, recently, you have much higher rates of return since really 2009. Now, part of that is a reversion to the mean. Part of that is everybody and their mother was scared and hated stocks back in 2009. And certainly a lot of that was a return to somewhat normalcy. But now after this big return over the past 6 years, what should you expect going forward from stocks? And there are a lot of different viewpoints on that. There's Robert Shiller from Yale, who talks about the Shiller P ratio, which is cyclically adjusted. And based on that, future returns should be very low. If you look at the results or the reports from Jeremy Grantham and the GMO research team, they see actually negative returns over the next 10 years for stocks. But then there's likes of Jeremy Siegel out of Wharton, who sees the low interest rates as a cause for higher than average valuations on stocks. So he thinks the returns can continue to go forward for some time. So there's a lot of ways to justify one side or the other. And I want to talk about that a little bit more coming up. And I want to hear from you. So give us a call. We're going to talk about what your 401k is really costing you in this next half hour as well. So give us a call. This is Invest Talk, where you can turn for straight talk about your money. Now, our first priority is answering your questions. Let's pick up a call that came before today's program on our 24-hour listener line at 888-99-CHART.
Hi, this is Phil in Oklahoma City. I listen to your excellent program via podcast. My question is this a good time to consider getting into Caterpillar given its recent weakness? I'd appreciate your comments. Thanks.
All right, he's looking at Caterpillar. This is one of the largest construction equipment makers in the world. They do a ton of sales. They do about $12 billion in sales per quarter, so roughly $50 billion in sales per year, yields 4%. They do have a decent amount of debt, which is worrisome, and their financial performance is flagging considerably. They made almost $9 a share in 2012. This year, they're only supposed to make $4.94 a share, down 20% from last year. Next year, earnings are supposed to fall another 8%. Sales are down 13% year over year. This quarter, earnings down 25% year over year this quarter. So they're obviously having a lot of financial difficulty. Now, their payout ratio remains fairly low, only 43%. So it seems that that dividend is fairly safe. However, the drop in the price has been considerable, and I think it could and likely will continue lower, probably into the $60 level, trading at $77.26. That's probably where I'd start to pick it up. I probably wouldn't pick it up until then. And really, it's all about the weakness in the mining sector. You have a lot of coal companies going out of business. Obviously, the production from the oil sector is starting to slow down. It's taken a little while, but that's certainly an area that's been under pressure and will likely continue to be relatively weak. I don't think we're going back to $100 oil anytime soon, but the coal industry is going through structural changes. No matter how you go about it, I think coal is going to be dead for a while. I think many decades, with the push for clean energy, etc., and all the environmental factors that play into coal, that's going to be a problem, and Caterpillar supplies a lot to the coal industry. So this is a good company. I like that it's on your watch list. The dividend is relatively safe, so I don't think that that's going to be an issue in the near term. They have plenty of cash flow, and it is relatively cheap, but if their sales continue to fall, it will become what we call a value trap. And until they start to turn around, I would stay away from a Caterpillar. I'd only touch it if it gets to that $60 a share level. Then it becomes bone-chilling cheap. I'll say that. So let's talk a little bit about the dollar, which is directly tied to Caterpillar and the whole commodities industry. And as we know, the dollar has been on a sharp rise ever since middle of last year. Coincidentally, that's pretty much around when Caterpillar started to really collapse. So you can see that correlation there. So what has it done besides push the prices of commodities lower? Everyone talks about oversupply of oil, etc. But the bottom line is the dollar is really what is weighing on the commodity sector. And the sharp rise in the dollar has sliced more than $100 billion off of dollar-denominated revenue at America's largest multinational companies this year. Companies like Nike and McDonald's and Goldman Sachs. Now, in the first half of the year, 10 of the largest American multinationals have had their sales reduced by a combined $31 billion. That includes Apple, GM, IBM, Johnson & Johnson, Amazon, GE. And companies within the S&P 500 earned roughly 48% of their revenue abroad last year. And that shows that there's a significant exposure to the dollar from S&P 500 companies. Now, in previous years, weak dollars were good. A weak dollar was very good for a lot of these multinationals. And that translated into increasing sales abroad, especially when you put them back into dollars here. Because those currencies appreciated, right? Now you're having the opposite effect. The trade-weighted dollar is up 19% from a year ago. And if you look at the earnings last quarter, while 70% of the companies beat on their earnings expectations, only 42% beat on their sales expectations. 41% fell short of their sales expectations. And when this happens, it squeezes margins as well, meaning executives have to lower prices abroad to stay competitive because it suddenly becomes cheaper to produce elsewhere. And Tobias Lefkowitz of UBS says that the dollar will shave roughly 3-4 percentage points from total S&P revenue this year. That's about $300 billion in revenue. So this is certainly a headwind. Now the big question is the dollar done? The dollar peaked out back in, what was that, March of this year, and has been slowly trading lower. Now this could be consolidation for another move higher, which would increase the pressure on commodities even more, the pressure on earnings on the S&P, not just from commodity names like ExxonMobil and Chevron, but multinationals that have exposure overseas. So this is an extremely important factor that everybody needs to be cognizant of. If you aren't paying attention to the dollar, you're not paying close enough attention to the market as a whole, because it is extremely important to what happens going forward. Now it's time for Invest Talk 101. How much is your 401k really costing you? Now you're paying fees on your 401k plan. A lot of people don't think they are, but they are, and usually that's in higher mutual fund fees. Okay? And fees are charged both on what you earn and what you contribute. And they're charged whether the market's up or market's down. Now, more than half of retirement plan participants don't know they're paying fees. And this is a survey that was published by MarketWatch.com. And of the folks that did know, only a quarter correctly identified how those fees are calculated. This was done by the National Association of Retirement Plan Participants, a nonprofit advocacy group that works on behalf of savers. And of course, participants have the right to know and understand what fees they're paying. But are they? That's the big question. There are new laws about disclosing these fees, and most of them are very complex and go on and on for many pages. And in 2004, the rules proposed that would require 401k plan providers to create guidelines for employers to help them read the fees. Now, the good news is the fees themselves are coming down slowly, and the average 401k plan charged a total cost of 91 basis points, meaning 0.91% of plan assets in 2012. That's down from 1% in 2009. Now, average fees are still significantly higher for smaller plans, but those are dropping as well. And there's a new DOL proposal that's going to get rid of a lot of conflicts of interest. And, you know, we love it because we don't have any of those for our 401ks we work with. But it's something everybody should understand and consider is what fees they're paying in their 401k, because that happens each and every year. So pay attention. Ask your employer for the current information on the fees that you're paying. And if you want to see more about this link, we have it there on investtalk.com. Just look under the Talking Point link, and it says link to InvestTalk personal article, and you will be able to see that and go to your employer. Try to see if they can push down those fees. Have them talk to somebody that can make sure that your plan is up to par when it comes to guidelines and lower fees, because it's very important over the long term to have good investment choices and low fees. So that's Invest Talk Personal, and I'd like to know what you'd like to know more about. Get in touch. We're here for you at 888-99-CHART, or write me a note. Click on the Contact Justin button or Steve on investtalk.com.
There's a link to today's Talking Point. Just look for the Monday, August 3rd heading on investtalk.com. Need help making an important money decision? Why not ask a professional financial advisor? 888-99-CHART is how to get through to Justin right now.
Hey guys, Chris from Louisville. Just had a quick question about Apple. Today, I went down a couple points and looked like went down as far as 117.5 in intraday trading. I wanted to see if this is a good time to add to your position. I know long term, but it's really, you know, a company to invest in. But, you know, in the short term, you know, are the shorts really pushing the stock down? Another reason why it's dropped so much lately. Thanks guys, appreciate all you do.
All right, he's looking at Apple, and it has had a decent pullback after earnings. It was near 133 or in change before earnings, and now it's down to 118 in change, so it's had a decent pullback. You've had poor showing from the Apple Watch, but Apple is still a good company, tons of cash on its balance sheet. It's the cream of the crop, I think, when it comes to tech companies, valuations, etc. I think this is a good place to add. Doesn't mean it can't go lower. I think there's a decent chance it might. But it depends on your time horizon. If you think for the next 2-3 months, next year, you could be disappointed if the market continues to weaken and pull back. But if you're looking long-term, I still think Apple's cheap. I still think this is a good buy point for the long-term. Short to medium-term, not quite as convinced. All right. So that was Apple. AAPL is the symbol. So let's talk a little bit about Puerto Rico. We have about 12 minutes left in the show, so if you do have a question, give us a call. But today it was announced that Puerto Rico is defaulting on a $58 million bond payment, interest payment, that was due on Saturday. And the Puerto Rico plans to prepare a debt restructuring plan by September 1st. There's a lot of issues going on with Puerto Rico, and I think it's important to step back and look at the history of Puerto Rican bonds and why this is such a big issue. Because Puerto Rico I mean, the size of their economy is minor compared to the U.S. as a whole, right? Well, the biggest issue with Puerto Rico is that it has been one of the most widely held municipal issues in all types of funds for a very long time. And it always traded at pretty low yields and lower yields than their credit quality really warranted for many, many years. And this is because they had triple tax exempt status, meaning that interest payments were exempt from federal, state, and local taxes across all U.S. states. So think of all the municipal bond funds that are out there, ETFs, mutual funds that are tied to a specific state. California, Wisconsin, Texas, whatever it is, there's one for every state out there in the union. Now, if you have a, say, Idaho tax-exempt bond fund, and maybe there's not enough attractive Idaho bond issued to supply all the demand for that particular bond fund, well, guess what you can go do? You can go buy Puerto Rico bonds because they're tax exempt in just the same way that all of the bonds inside of Idaho, for example, are tax exempt for Idaho residents. So that triple tax exempt status allowed the Puerto Rican bond market to grow much bigger than it otherwise would have because of the liquidity. And it also provides diversification as well, if you think about it. And for many years, Puerto Rico was rated AAA. So it increased the credit quality of the overall bond portfolio because of that AAA rating. And the yield spreads were decent for how, quote-unquote, safe they were. Now, the biggest issue is bond insurers also backed a lot of these bonds. I mean, they wrote insurance on these bonds. So this was the impetus for getting the Puerto Rican bond market so large. So after the break, I want to talk about where we've been in the past 8 years or so, from 07 to 2015 when it comes to Puerto Rican bonds. Give us a call, 888-99-CHART.
Our podcast distribution is made possible each day by KPP Financial, Steve Peasley, President. Proper diversification of a portfolio is one of the top guidelines of portfolio management. Check out our info sheet on diversification. It's yours free with your insider membership, which also gives you access to our recorded webinars. Anybody can sign up. It's free. Just go to investtalk.com.
Now, we're here for you, beginner or experienced investor, at 888-99-CHART. Now, if you're a podcast listener or can't reach us during our live program, 4 to 5 Pacific time, you can always leave your question, and we will answer it on the next show, just like Matt did in Walnut Creek.
Hi. I listened to someone on the radio, a trader. I won't name names, and I'm not here to bash, just get some info. His approach is perhaps overly simplistic, I don't know. He's just about all technicals, and he says, we buy when the big institutions are buying and get out when they get out of a stock. Looking at a chart, how would one know that? From volume? I don't know. Of course, he talks about support and resistance levels. Is that basically the institutions because they're the ones that move stocks? Thanks for your help.
It is true that institutions are the ones that really move stocks. There are certain ways that you can see what the big institutions are doing. There are services out there will show you what mutual funds, how many mutual funds are in a particular issue and what that trend has been recently. You know, we have that software. So that can be helpful. There are a lot of institutions that will not buy a stock unless it's trading above its 50-day moving average. That's pretty common as well. So that's something to consider. And There's nothing wrong with that technical analysis approach. It's different. There's more than one way to skin a cat. It doesn't mean it's perfect. You can get whipsawed out of the market using strictly technical analysis. But understanding what the institutions are doing is very important. I'll give them that. It's probably one of the most important aspects of investing and investing in the stock market is to see what big institutions are doing, because what they're doing is the most important part of the ebbs and flows in the marketplace. And piggybacking on that, let's go back to talking about Puerto Rico. And I talked a little bit about why it became so big, such a big part of the municipal bond sector, is because they're rated AAA for a long time, triple tax exempt. And it was only in about August 2013 when there was an issue from the island's their power authority, the power authority on Puerto Rico. They brought a bond issue to market. And only then, in August 2013, were investors becoming more concerned about the issuer's fundamentals. And the deal was placed at yields that clearly reflected a much higher risk than the investment grade status that the big rating agencies were still giving Puerto Rico. And it just goes to show you that the bond market knows ahead of these rating agencies. The rating agencies are always behind the curve, not ahead of the curve. And in fact, in March 2014, the Puerto Rican general obligation bonds came to market, and many municipal bond mutual funds were no longer willing to buy that issue because, guess what? By that time, the rating agencies had downgraded Puerto Rico to junk status. And that has changed the role of Puerto Rico in the bond fund market. In 2007, the Puerto Rican bonds made up 3% of the high yield sector and also 3% of the investment grade municipal bond sector. Now in 2015, Puerto Rico makes up 23.5% of the high yield municipal bond sector and only 1.25% of the investment grade municipal bond sector. So it's become a high yield issue. It's certainly a lot of people are going to be hurt by this, especially if you own high yield municipal bond mutual funds. And this is another example, and Steve and I have talked about this a lot, of why these low interest rates are dangerous for people, because they go and chase this yield and they take higher risk than they really understand. And this is one example of how this one little tiny island that's a U.S. territory is throwing a monkey wrench into the high yield municipal bond sector. And, you know, there are many in the non-muni sector that are going to show its ugly head as well. And that's why high yield bonds are dangerous. Now, we're out of time for today. A reminder about Steve's monthly retirement checkup schedule. He will be in San Jose tomorrow for these individual meetings with our listeners and clients. And to take advantage of this free service, you can call our 24-hour listener line at 888-99-CHART and follow the prompts, or go to investtalk.com, click on the Schedule a Meeting button. I'm financial advisor Justin Klein, and for Steve Peasley and everyone at KPP Financial, thank you for listening. I hope you have a good evening. Let's meet here again tomorrow.
Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for listeners to understand that not all comments made will apply to them specifically. Nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell securities. Such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis, and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. Steve Peasley and Justin Klein are principals of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, which retains all rights.